It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. If you thought it was supposed to be March today because yesterday was supposed to be the end of February, hang on, it's leap year. This quirk in the calendar gives us an extra day this month that comes around every 4 years, mostly. How do we celebrate? Mostly we don't, except in this 2012 scene from the TV show 30 Rock, where Tina Fey's lead character Liz Lemon finds her colleague celebrating at the feet of Leap Day William, or Jack McBriar as Kenneth the NBC page.
Why, Leap Day William is visiting.
Leap Day William?
Miss Lemon, did you not grow up with Leap Day William? He lives in the Mariana Trench. He emerges every 4 years to trade children's tears for candy.
What? No!
We'll find out how a few Wisconsin establishments are making the most of this extra day of 2024, and then we'll dig into the science behind the extra day. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is February 29th a special day to you or someone you know? Your birthday or your kid's birthday or anniversary? How do you handle only having that day come around every 4 years? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert DeAndrea is WPR's Lee Esther News Fellow. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, you found a few celebrations. They're few and far between, it looks like. We just heard that 30 Rock Leap Day episode. Art has become reality. Some places are actually having their Leap Day William celebrations.
Yes, well, this really, I fell into my lap yesterday when I was looking for things. I was not planning on this, but I'm a 30 Rock super fan, and I was really glad to find it. Leap Day is, I think, the most popular 30 Rock inspired holiday. You know, there's also Merlin Peen and Luda Christmas that happen around the solstice. There's the Valentine's Day alternative and a Howard Shaw Day, but really Leap Day is the 30 Rock holiday.
And you found a modern brewery owner building an event around that dozen-year-old TV episode.
Yes, he told me that he did it in 2020 as well and didn't actually let customers in on the joke, just showed up dressed as Leap Day William, everything decorated in yellow and blue and giving out candy. And I guess there were people who didn't really understand what was happening, but now that it's been 12 years, he felt the need to explain ahead of time.
And I'll let the listeners out there know that I did wear yellow and blue in celebration of Leap Day William. Now, another small business you wrote about, this is all at WPR.org, by the way, using the every 4 years angle to start a time capsule project. What's the story there?
Yeah, so the Crazy Dog Mom, which is in Stoughton, is a boutique for healthy pet treats and gimmicky t-shirts for pet owners. And they have a variety of dog-centric events for holidays you can bring your dog in to celebrate. So for Leap Day, a dog time capsule that would be put away for 4 years.
And what goes in a dog time capsule?
It could be any memento of a dog, acquiring a dog, a favorite toy perhaps, or the dogs can, as a part of this event, can make artwork that would go into the time capsule.
All right, and then from Stoughton over to Stockholm in Wisconsin, a small town lot going on there now, and they've got kind of a mysterious way to observe the rare day. What is planned there?
So the Humble Moon Saloon, this is actually going to be tomorrow, Friday night, but a masquerade ball themed around Leap Day. I understand you've been to this.
I've been to Stockholm. I've been to the Humble Moon. Yeah. So a masquerade party to celebrate the bonus day.
Yes.
And
take a leap.
And Robert, before we let you go, have you done anything special to observe Leap Day apart from reporting on all of this?
That really was the treat. that was me living and saving real life for March.
All right. Well, anybody out there who celebrates a Leap Day in a special way, let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pass that along to Robert. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, that's Robert DeAndrea, WPR's Lee Esther News Fellow, looking at some of the ways people are celebrating Leap Day in Wisconsin. Now, why do we even have a leap day and year in the first place? Jim Lattice is with us, director of the UW Space Place. He's a faculty associate in astronomy with the UW College of Letters and Science. His expertise includes the history of astronomy and cosmology. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob.
All right, so this is about space and science and the sun and the moon, right? Why do we end up having to tack on this extra day mostly every 4 years?
Yeah, well, you know, it's there is some astronomy in there, but it's almost just a matter of arithmetic. The problem, I was thinking about how to explain this most easily. You know, if it turns out that the time that it takes the Earth to go around the sun one time is not an even number of days. If it were 365 days, that would be handy, but it's actually more like 365 and a quarter. Suppose it was 365 and a half days. Then we could alternate. We could have 365 days in a year, and then the next year 366, and then go back to 365, and we would average then 365 and a half, and then we would match the period of the Earth's orbit. If we don't match the period of the Earth's orbit, then the seasons shift around in the calendar, and people have been uncomfortable with that for a long time. So it's just a trick. It's the question of getting that average right, and 365 days for 3 years and 366 for 1 year gets us pretty close, and that's the leap day. Pretty close, not exact.
And once upon a time, though, depending on whose calendar you're looking at, the calendar got out of sync, right? So February might be in the middle of the summer and not just feel like February is in the middle of the summer like it did 2 days
right,
ago.
Yes, our apparent February. No, the it never did drift quite that far, at least not in modern times, but it did drift. And so, right, the one leap year every fourth year, the extra day every fourth year, isn't quite right. And so that will drift actually a full day over about 130 years. So that's what was happening, because the Julian calendar, which does just that, the one leap year in every four common years, every three common years, that was established by essentially Julius Caesar in the Roman Empire, and they used that then right on up through right on up into the Middle Ages, and quite a few periods of 130 years passed by there. So they were about 10 days out. So the vernal equinox had slipped about 10 days by the time they were in the 1500s. And that's when people started saying, well, we got to do something about this.
And we skip some of the every 4 years, right? Is it every 100th year we don't leap day?
Right, because the once every 4 years is overcompensating just a little bit. So instead of a strict one every 4 years, we skip one leap year out of 100 years. So the easy way, the rule for this, and these rules are all nice and easy. It's interesting if you think about this. There's not really anything too complicated here. Every year that's divisible by 100, we skip that leap year. We don't have that leap year because it would be divisible by 4. So it would be a normal year by the simple rule, by the Julian rule. But then that turns out that compensates a little bit too much the other way. So there's another term in there, which is if the year is divisible by 400, that's a century year. But instead of skipping the leap year, we add it back in. So we're adding one every 4 years and then subtracting one every 100 years, then adding back in one every 400 years. And that gets us pretty close.
I think we've got a leap day celebrant on the phone now. Michael joins us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, happy leap day. Good Merlin peen to you. I know I'm off day, off calendar. I was originally calling just to say that I love 30 Rock and Leap Day William and was just happy to be hearing about it on WPR because I thoroughly confused my family with a Leap Day William gif this morning. But I do actually, now that the guest has changed, have a different question. I was wondering, do you happen to know, because I know the Mayans had some of the most accurate of ancient calendars and timekeeping, did they have a method for accounting for the fractional year length or do you know?
Interesting, Michael. I know you've tracked from the Romans kind of through our tradition. I don't know if you've looked at the Mayan calendar, Jim.
I can't say I know much about the Mayan calendar. Certainly, they were not using the Julian or Gregorian calendars.
Because no Julius or Gregory.
Right. And they were interested in other time periods. So we're focusing here. In fact, you could say the whole problem arises because we're focused on the seasons, because which stem from the equinoxes and solstices. And so we're concerned about keeping our day count linked to the seasons. What little I know about the Mayans is they were interested in other day counts. They might have been interested in the annual, the solar cycle day count, for all I know. But they were also very interested in things like day counts from one elongation of Venus to the next elongation of Venus and things like that. So you can choose whatever of these astronomical cycles that you think are important, and then you can try to adjust your day counts to try to match them if that's what you're going to be obsessed about. So we wouldn't worry too much about this if it wasn't that we are obsessed with keeping certain dates. Like, we wouldn't like it if Christmas falls in the summertime. We want to keep it where it is. So no, I don't know about the Mayans, I'm afraid, in any detail, but they did have similar problems, because none of these orbital periods and rotational periods and things like that are mutually commensurable. They're all totally inconvenient numbers.
Michael, thanks for the call. We're talking about the history and science of leap years and leap day, which is today. Jim Lattice stays with us, director of the UW Space Place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about leap day, whys and wherefores, how it all fits together? Do you do anything special with that extra day of the year? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the history and science behind leap years and days. Jim Lattice is with us, director of the UW Space Place and faculty associate in astronomy with the UW College of Letters and Science. You can join in with your leap year related questions at 800-642-1234. So, Jim, you've mentioned the Gregorian calendar named after Pope Gregory. You sent us some notes here. Pope Gregory the 13th, as part of the plan to get that into place, they skipped days on the calendar. You went to bed, I think it was on October 4th, and woke up on October 15th.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, that's that drift that was not accounted for in the Julian calendar. And they saw, 10 days, well, that's not going to put December, that's not going to put Christmas in the summer. But it's they saw the problem looming there. So that was their way of fixing this. There were other proposals, like maybe we ought to drop one day a year for a few years in a row, but they settled on, so there was the Pope formed a commission that was not just astronomers and technical experts, but was lawyers and theologians and people like that, trying to kick around all the implications of changing the calendar. And they seem to have decided that the smoothest road to getting this to work was just to do it all at once. Just get it over, as you say, wake up on the 15th and there you are.
Let's go back to our callers. Stephen is with us in Appleton. Stephen, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, when are we most accurate and on time? Like, if it's leap year day, what time or what year or what day can we, like, say we're exactly aligned with the clock? Like, I make a wish at 11:11, and I feel like I'm off now, and I'm wondering, what is the perfect time to make a wish?
Stephen, thanks for the call. This ends up being, I think, a philosophical question a little bit, Jim, but also, like, time is relative. It depends on what you're setting your clock by.
Well, so the only thing that we're trying to match up here on the calendar is the timing of the vernal equinox. Well, usually we use the vernal equinox. It could be any of those quarter days, but the vernal equinox will occur at some certain time on about March 21st, and the next common year will be off by about a quarter of a day, because we'll start counting again after 365, but the equinox will not quite have happened by 6 hours. And then the following year, 12 hours. The following year, 18 hours. The following year would be 24 hours, except then we say, oh, wait, let's throw in that other day in February, and now we match back up again. So it's only the only discrepancy that we're talking about here is between the calendar and the position of the Earth in its orbit at the vernal equinox. So your clock is not getting more or less accurate as we go through the year. You're measuring that with respect to the Earth's rotation, not with its orbit.
Thanks a lot for the question, Stephen. And speaking of keeping our clocks on pace, every now and then I see like an international group of astronomers and others adds or deducts leap seconds. How does that fit in?
Yeah, so that's a related approach. So what we call leap day is technically what we call an intercalary day. When we insert something into the calendar to manipulate it one way or the other, that's called intercalary. There are calendars with intercalary months. The Jewish ritual calendar inserts an extra month every so often to keep in sync with the seasons, even though that's a lunar calendar. Well, we intercalate in the Gregorian calendar. We intercalate a day. That's the leap day. So the Earth's the leap second isn't too closely related to that whole calendar mm-hmm. issue. But the Earth's rotation actually is not constant, occasionally there are not quite exactly the right number of seconds in a day. And if you let that accumulate, of course, eventually you'll get to a few seconds. But especially these days, those sorts of timekeeping problems in networks and things like that can have big consequences. Inserting the leap second there is a way of compensating for the actual irregularity of the Earth's rotation.
And just, we've got a few moments left, Jim. Switching topics here, big solar eclipse coming.
Right.
Pretty excited about that. Are you going to journey southward to catch the full show?
Yes, I hope to, although we will have events here in Madison where that's April 8th, in the afternoon of April 8th, and that eclipse will be total across a good bit of the United States, not here. It'll be a partial eclipse here. You'll need proper eclipse viewing glasses to watch that or observe it other safe ways. It'll be the last one that crosses the continental U.S. for about 20 years. So if you want to see the total eclipse, you'll have to drive to maybe Ohio or Indiana, somewhere like that.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
That's Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place. He's a faculty associate in astronomy with UW College of Letters and Science. We talked to him today about why we observe a leap year and leap day in the first place. Getting older can be expensive. One national group estimated the average annual cost for assisted living care would be more than $60,000 in Wisconsin this year. Seniors and adults with disabilities who run out of savings can get help to cover those costs through the state's Medicaid program. But the transition from paying out of pocket to using Medicaid has led to some residents being kicked out. Wisconsin saw a series of Medicaid recipients forced to relocate in 2022 and 2023. Experts say more funding and regulation are needed, but Addie Costello reports that not much has changed since those incidents.
Sitting at his kitchen table, Dale Hunke flips through pages of documents from his parents' assisted living facilities. He pulls the files from a stretched-out accordion folder where he organizes records from years of helping his parents find long-term care.
I never thought about this day coming, but it comes, and you get through it.
In 2021, Hunke helped his parents move to what is now a Cedarhurst assisted living facility in Verona.
It was a perfect spot for them.
Part of what made it perfect was that they accepted Medicaid. Hunke estimated his parents could afford roughly 2 years of care. After that, they would need Medicaid. Hunke's dad successfully made the transition before he passed away in 2022. But months later, when Hunke's mom was nearing her transition, he found out Cedarhurst in Verona ended its Medicaid contract.
I've done the best I could with shielding mom from the worst of it.
But none of his carefully kept records could prevent the 88-year-old woman from having to move. Federal law bans nursing homes from rejecting residents because of a transition to Medicaid, if the facility accepted Medicaid when the resident moved in. But no state or federal policies protect assisted living residents in the same situation, leaving families like Hunky's to scramble to find new care.
I was just consumed with it. I did nothing else for 3 days, I think, because at that point, I was like, I've got to get her out of there.
Facilities don't want to force seniors out of their home, says Mike Bahowski. He's the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Assisted Living Association. But, he says, Wisconsin's Medicaid program doesn't pay enough to cover the cost of most recipients' care.
We've had a number of facilities have to close in 2022 because they cannot make financial ends meet because the reimbursement rate is so low.
Wisconsin's Department of Health Services is hoping to get a small increase to reimbursement rates approved later this year using temporary pandemic relief funds. But current reimbursements have led some facilities to end their Medicaid contracts entirely. More commonly, facilities set stricter financial requirements for residents. Many require prospective residents to show that they can pay for 1, 2, or even 3 years of care out of pocket in order to stay at the facility once they transition to Medicaid.
Sometimes even that written agreement might not hold up.
That's Kim Marhaney, Wisconsin State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. She says if an assisted living facility is sold or ends its Medicaid contract, they can get out of the agreement.
We see residents who have spent 2 to 3 years and more of their own personal dollars that are being asked to move someplace else.
Out-of-pocket pay requirements also limit care for seniors already on Medicaid.
We are starting to see those gaps where there just isn't the diversity of options available to consumers that there used to be.
And Eric Carlson believes accepting Medicaid only after out-of-pocket pay violates federal law. He's an attorney and advocacy director with the legal nonprofit Justice and Aging.
You can't put the screws to people who are eligible for Medicaid because your promise to the state Medicaid program is that you will accept Medicaid, and that's not conditional.
Legal or not, Dale Hunke says by the time they found out she needed to move, his mother was just months away from needing Medicaid, leaving Hunke with just 3 options to tour. The first 2 were immediate no's, but the last facility...
It was like an answer to our prayers.
Despite her limited savings, the facility accepted his mom. She moved there in June, and this month, she successfully transitioned to Medicaid. Addie Costello, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about that story and follow all the latest reporting from our news department over at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments yesterday in a case related to a Trump-era federal ban on the use of bump stocks. Bump stocks are devices that allow semi-automatic weapons to fire, in some cases up to hundreds of rounds per minute, much faster than they could otherwise. The Trump administration banned the devices on the 1-year anniversary of the 2017 Las Vegas shooting, the deadliest in U.S. history. We're talking about that Supreme Court case questioning the legality of the federal ban on bump stocks, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with this current ban on these bump stock devices? Do you think they should be protected by law? If you're a firearm owner, have you ever used one of these? What are you hoping to see as this case plays out? Join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwabers, a professor emeritus of political science at UW-Madison and affiliate of the UW Law School. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Before we get to the bump stocks themselves, Howard, a lot of this hinges on bans on machine guns, on fully automatic firearms, mostly banned, going back as far as 1934, updated over the years. Could you give us some of the background there?
Sure. It gets a little bit complicated because the ban on machine guns was one of a number of bans on firearms, which were really of various sorts, which are really quite common throughout modern American history and even back into the colonial period. Various bans of who could own a gun or who could sell a gun or how many guns one could own or what types of gun. In the 20th century, the issue was treated as a constitutional question by the Supreme Court. And up until just a few years ago, the answer was there was no right to own military weapons. And so legislatures went around banning weapons of a type that couldn't be used for things like hunting. or were not standard weapons to be used, as the phrase was. In, of course, the famous Heller case in the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms, and left open whether any arms at all could be regulated. And then just last year, in the Bruin case, the Supreme Court issued this extreme ruling that said regulations having to do with a right in the Bill of Rights, like the Second Amendment, which that case was about, are only constitutional if there were parallel regulations of that type in the colonial period. The reason I'm sharing all this constitutional background is that even though this case is not about the Second Amendment, it's only about the interpretation of a statute, that Second Amendment issue is lurking in the background, because this statute, as you pointed out, goes back to the 1930s, and other statutes of this kind go back to the 1930s, for example, laws against sawed-off shotguns and other things of that sort. And all of those laws are called into question by recent actions of the Supreme Court on constitutional grounds. So that makes this case really interesting, because while debating the meaning of the statute, and specifically the meaning of machine gun under the statute, the justices were being forced to wrestle with the implications of their own earlier statements about gun rights.
It seems like a lot of the argument, though, hinged on whether using these bump stocks to up the rate of fire of a semi-automatic weapon made them the equivalent of a machine gun, and whether the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives had the right to interpret the existing laws in that way. And it seemed like there was a lot of hair splitting going on. What did you see there?
That's exactly right. And the word that comes to mind is Jesuitical. This sounded like a theological debate about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. So it's almost hard to say this with a straight face, but the argument was, is there a difference between a weapon that fires a lot of bullets when you just pull the trigger with your finger, as opposed to a weapon that fires an equal number of bullets equally quickly if you have to push it with your shoulder? That was the entirety of the dispute and the question of whether this is or is not a machine gun. Mr. Cargill and his attorneys argued that because something was involved other than just squeezing with one's finger, these are not machine guns. And Justice Barrett, for example, seemed quite sympathetic to that. Other justices, though, including, interestingly, Justices Thomas and Gorsuch, Alito, seemed quite concerned with the idea that this was a technicality used to avoid Congress's clear intent, which was, as they put it, to ban extremely lethal weapons. I think it was Justice Alito who asked the attorneys for Cargill, the guy with the gun shop, could you imagine a member of Congress passing this law who didn't think it would cover devices of this kind? So there's that whole hyper-technical linguistic issue about how to read a word in a statute and whether to take account its purpose or not, or whether to read it in some strict hyper-formal dictionary way. The second piece, which you alluded to quite correctly, is whether the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms exceeded their mandate in reaching that conclusion. So here the issue has to do with the fact that for a long time, ATF did not ban bump stocks. Their explanation is that the manufacturers of bump stocks originally marketed them and presented them to the ATF as devices to be useful to people who had very physical injuries, physical weaknesses, such as their hands weren't strong enough to fire an ordinary gun. Over time, the devices began to be more and more marketed and used as weapons of mass destruction, to exaggerate only slightly, and so the ATF changes position. But this becomes part of a very, very big debate going on in an enormous number of areas, in which the Roberts Court is considering how much government agencies should have authority to interpret their own mandates and determine the scope of their authority. The technical name of this is Chevron deference, and the important thing to know is that it's not just about guns, it's about environmental regulation, it's about commercial regulation and business regulation, and the whole question of how much authority executive agencies, including the ATF, have to carry out their mandates through a broad as opposed to very, very narrow and specific interpretation of words like machine gun. That issue is on the table as well. So there's a lot wrapped up into what looks like a very technical and narrow case.
I want to dig more into that last point, and this is something that a lot of people are watching for. To what extent does a federal agency, in this case, the ATF, have to interpret to say, okay, here's this law from Congress. We think it applies to bump stocks as opposed to what we used to just call machine guns. And then the argument saying, well, if Congress meant bump stocks, they would have said bump stocks. And if they want to make it mean bump stocks, well, then Congress has to go back and do it. You, federal agency, don't have that interpretive power. Extending that across a lot of departments, that could be a pretty big deal, right?
It's an enormous deal. There are at least three cases before the Supreme Court this term that the Roberts Court could, if they want to, use to dramatically scale back the independence of executive agencies. And let's present the arguments on both sides. I think you just presented the argument for narrowing that authority. That is, if Congress wants an agency to have specific authority, they should say so. But the counter argument is most easily illustrated, I think, with things like pollutants. Congress can't possibly list every dangerous pollutant. And if they could list every dangerous pollutant, people might invent new ones. So we give the Environmental Protection Agency, traditionally, authority to identify dangerous pollutants and therefore regulate them. Similarly, Congress, the argument would be, can't possibly think of every innovation like a bump stock or a ghost gun. Those are guns that are manufactured in ways such that they're not traceable, that someone's going to come up with in order to evade gun regulations. And so it's essential, if agencies are to carry out their mandate, to carry out the policies Congress creates them to carry out, that Congress give them flexibility to decide the details, the rulemaking as opposed to the lawmaking, as it's said. Those are the two basic positions. The problem with insisting that Congress must specify everything, one is that's essentially not what Congress is good at and would require an enormous increase in manpower, and they probably just can't do it. But of course, the other problem is that Congress is at present pretty dysfunctional and very frozen. So a ruling that says agencies only have the authority that Congress explicitly grants to them would effectively dramatically diminish the authority of agencies across the board. Up until now, for decades, the principle has been that where an agency interprets its mandate in a new way, like to cover bump stocks under machine guns, as long as that interpretation is reasonable, courts will uphold it. That's that deference I was mentioning. And the Roberts Court has signaled before that it's open to radically reconsidering that deference. And as I say, this is one of several cases this term in which that could occur.
Howard Schwaber is with us, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. He's talking to us about Garland versus Cargill. That's a case before the U.S. Supreme Court questioning whether a Trump-era ban on these bump stocks for firearms that effectively increase the rate of fire for semi-automatic weapons, whether that ban is legal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this bump stock case at the Supreme Court? Are firearms an important political issue for you? What do you want to see come out of this from the court? Do you worry that court rulings would limit the power of federal agencies to regulate firearms, pollutants, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Howard Schwaber, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court case questioning whether a Trump-era ban on bump stocks is legal. These are a firearm-modifying device that can increase the rate of fire for semi-automatic weapons. The ATF, under President Trump, after the huge Las Vegas tragedy, said, hey, this effectively makes them machine guns and makes them illegal under current law. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with that Trump-era ban on these bump stock devices? If the Supreme Court reverses the ban, what would you like to see happen next? Maybe action in Congress? Have you ever fired a firearm with a bump stock? What was it like? Did you notice that difference? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Howard Schwaber, mentioned earlier these were pretty technical arguments. I want to get a taste of that. Here's Justice Elena Kagan asking Justice Department lawyer Brian Fletcher about the intricacies of using a machine gun versus a semi-automatic gun fitted with a bump stock.
Would it be right to say that the pressure is, you know, on a typical machine gun where you're pulling and you're feeling, you know, continual backward pressure? And on this, you're feeling continual forward pressure of the opposite hand.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly right. I think that's exactly what the district court found.
So is the case, do you think, Howard, going to be decided narrowly on functional arguments over how a bump stock works versus a machine gun works and whether, therefore, it fits under that illegal category?
I certainly hope not. And I say that not only because of whatever feelings I might have about gun safety and gun laws, but because as a mode of statutory interpretation, that's kind of horrifying. Laws are passed for purposes, and it should not be the job, certainly in my view, and I'm not alone in this at all, of the courts to interpret laws so technically and so narrowly that they can't do the jobs for which they were passed in the first place. This just opens the door for an infinite range of ways to evade legal restrictions on any number of things by doing something that doesn't quite exactly fit the specific technical description. I mean, the difference between pulling with your trigger, with your finger, and feeling a recoil and leaning forward with your shoulder and feeling a recoil, the idea that that could make the difference between as legal and illegal on something as lethal as a bump stock equipped semi-automatic weapon seems to me a terrible usurpation by the courts of their proper role when it comes to statutes.
Now, we have a 6-3 generally regarded conservative majority Republican appointees on the court. I've seen, Howard, a lot of observers say, hey, you got to watch Justice Amy Coney Barrett on this case in particular, potentially as a swing vote one way or another. What did you make of her line of questioning yesterday?
So Justice Barrett's line of questioning was really what we've just been describing, but taken to an even greater degree. I mean, really about, you know, is there a difference between squeezing a trigger once and holding it to create the multiple fire, or squeezing a trigger once, holding it, and then leaning forward with a shoulder to create the multiple rate of fire? Excuse me. Would it make a difference if a small plastic post were inserted in the trigger so your finger was not involved? I called this theological reasoning earlier a little bit sarcastically, obviously. But it really does come down to parsing words in a way that, first of all, no serious linguistic theorist or dictionary author would ever take seriously. I mean, the idea that words have this level of precision and the idea that they can be given this level of precision in a situation where we're talking about legislative intent and public policy seems to me just a really terrible indictment of just how ridiculously formalistic these justices have become. I will say, though, that it may not be the case that Barrett will be a swing vote. As I mentioned earlier, I think Justices Thomas and Alito asked some fairly probing question of the lawyer defending bump stocks that suggests their vote may not be as obvious as we think.
To bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Julie is with us in Madison. Julie, hi.
Hi. It seems a little bit very technical as an argument. I come at guns from the point of view of a target shooter, both the high-powered rifle range. My guns are always taken apart and clean when I'm done using them, and then I don't put them back together again, so they're basically just parts until I'm ready to use them again, and I no point in picking up bullets to have on hand. It, you know, you pick those up on the way to the range, so I don't really understand what people are doing with all these assembled guns. It sort of makes no sense.
Julie, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Is part of the argument, Howard, the intent of what people would use a bump stock for and that rate of fire for and the reasons that might be available to the public, or we'd want to exclude it to the public?
Well, first of all, kudos to Julie for practicing good gun safety. And she's exactly right. There is no target shooting or sport-related reason to want a bump stock, nor is it a hunting weapon. This is a killing weapon. And it's used by people who do keep their guns assembled because they assert that they have a need to have them readily available to shoot at people. That's a thing that we as a society have decided to allow, and that our Supreme Court says our Constitution guarantees people to be able to do, but our legislatures have attempted to put a limit on just how lethal those weapons can be. So Julie's exactly right. This entire conversation is taking place in the context of people who are saying, I want to have guns with bump stocks so that I can kill people more effectively, and claiming they may have a legitimate reason to do that, and other people saying, no, there is never a legitimate reason to kill people that effectively, and we should be allowed to ban these things.
Thanks for the call. Mike joins us now in Shell Lake. Mike, hi. What did you want to bring up?
The bump stock thing. I want to say, first of all, that I am a part-time firearms instructor as well. I wanted to read the bump stock. Anybody that knows much about these things would not have one on their rifle. The rate of fire does increase, but it's not, the rate of fire isn't, if you have any sort of trigger control or time and practice with a rifle, the increase isn't that substantial. And you know, people get them, they go out and they fire them off, and, you know, at their homes or in the range. And I wouldn't know anyone that would have one for the purpose of defending themselves. Mm. You have less control over the weapon, and it just isn't a legitimate thing that you would use to defend yourself.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. That's getting to what you were talking about, Howard, and I've seen people make the case that the one use case is firing into a crowd where that lack of control wouldn't matter. Is this part of the argument, again, at the Supreme Court about whether these bump stocks should be legal?
Well, no one got into that specifics in detail. I have to apologize. I couldn't hear that telephone call perfectly, but I gather the caller is a firearms instructor.
Correct.
A lot of experience.
Correct. And his
expertise.
His case was people serious about guns don't want these bump stocks,
right.
and he questioned the self-defense value of them, yeah.
Right, because they don't increase your rate of fire all that much initially, and because they make the weapon hard to control. Mm-hmm. I say initially because if you combine a bump stock with an extra large magazine, then according to the ATF, as you said in the intro to this discussion, it's possible to fire more than 100 rounds in a minute, which is difficult to do if you have to stop and reload and fire it manually. The main point is, as the caller points out, these things don't have a legitimate use for sport or hunting, and arguably even for self-defense. The one obvious application that they have is for something like a mass shooting. Or I imagine one could hypothesize a situation which is an oncoming mob and you want to fire indiscriminately. The Solicitor General, Ms. Preligar, made an interesting comment in her brief. She called these dangerous and unusual weapons. The reason for that phrasing harkens back to those constitutional arguments we were talking about. Even if you have a right to have a gun for self-defense, that doesn't necessarily mean you have the right to, let's say, an Uzi, a notoriously inaccurate weapon, whose use is primarily to spray, right? And we could make an argument that spraying bullets is not a legitimately defined self-defense goal. I think the Solicitor General was trying to suggest with that language about dangerous and unusual that bump stocks fall into the same category. And our caller, who is expert in these matters, seems to agree. And so I have to say, I think he has a very good argument. The problem is that was not the focus of the justices' debates and questions. And somehow, when we talk about guns, getting to focus on the question of what's the justification for having these particular items, whatever it is that we're arguing about, and what limits can we put on just how dangerous they can be? Those kind of questions seem to get lost in obscure linguistic hair splitting and, frankly, disingenuous historical arguments.
Mike, thanks for that call. Howard, in just our last half a minute or so, what kind of timeline do we expect after the Supreme Court hears an oral argument to where we're going to get a decision on this?
Oh, it depends how long it will take a majority to reach an agreement. And by convention, the court also waits until all dissenters have had their say and finished their opinions. So it could be as late as June, certainly this term, I expect a ruling. It could be as soon as late in April or middle April, or it could be as late as June, but certainly in the next few months.
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Howard Schwaber, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison and affiliate of the UW Law School. He joined us today to look at a U.S. Supreme Court case on whether to overturn a Trump-era federal ban on bump stocks for firearms. You can keep sharing your thoughts on that issue. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, unions have declined in numbers over the years, in part because of so-called right-to-work laws that limit bargaining power in many states. Kate and her guests dig into the history and the impact of those changes. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. And by the way, thank you to everyone who gave yesterday during our one-day member drive and in the days leading up to it. It was a big success. We didn't know if we could really do a full week of fundraising in one day. We were able to, thanks to your help. Again, thanks so much for your support. It's award season in the entertainment world. The Grammys just happened a few weeks back. The Oscars are coming up, but here's one you might have missed. The award for the best dance performance that educates the world about scientific research. As reported at science.org and elsewhere, the annual Dance Your PhD contest invites scientists to translate their research into a dance performance. The origins go back to 2006 when a scientist hosted a New Year's Eve dance party, realized that none of the other scientists were dancing, and created the contest to solve the problem. This year's winner was a Brazilian researcher working in Australia studying the social lives of kangaroos. The song and dance number called Kangaroo Time uses dance to illustrate the ways kangaroos connect with one another socially. Second place went to a black and white old-fashioned dance movie about brown-tailed moths in Maine. Wisconsin scientists, you have a clear mission. Dance your way to victory next year. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Regular screening for colon cancer begins at age 45, but it's growing as a concern at younger ages. Over the last two decades, young people have been seeing higher rates of colorectal cancer. For people under the age of 50, it's now a top cause of cancer-related deaths, number one for men, second place for women. A Wisconsin colorectal cancer specialist is here with us to talk about possible causes behind that, how to know if you might be at risk, and what's out there for diagnosis and treatment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a family history of colorectal cancer? Did you have to get screened early at some point? Has this affected your life or someone in your family? If you're a healthcare provider, are you seeing this colorectal cancer happening more often with younger patients? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Noel Lacanti is a UW Health Medical Oncologist and Associate Professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Lacanti, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
First of all, can you tell us some of the basics of what colorectal cancer is?
Yeah, sure. The colon and the rectum is also known as the large intestine. Obviously, everybody has one, so we're all at risk for this type of cancer. It has been going down in totality because of screening. There are many different ways to screen. We can get into that later, but we've been seeing this fairly dramatic rise in early onset colorectal cancer over the last 20 years. So that would be people under the age of 50.
And as I read up on this, I might think, okay, well, maybe we're seeing a rise in this because we're looking for it more, getting better at diagnosing it. And the consensus seems to be, no, it legitimately seems to be happening more. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely not. It's generally being seen in people that aren't being screened at all or aren't eligible for screening.
And is this the case where before this rise, you know, this would be pretty a low priority? If somebody presented with symptoms, it would still seem pretty unlikely that that younger person would have some kind of colorectal cancer?
Can you repeat the question? Yeah. So someone has symptoms, are they...
Like back in the day, this is something that I think providers would not even look for in young people, right?
Yeah, right. And it's still... you know, there are other things that might cause these symptoms too, but we just don't want people to forget about colon cancer. You can see it in very young people. We're even seeing it in teens now. So we need to keep it on our list.
And one of the big open question is what would be causing this? And I don't think we have a solid answer, but what are some of the notions as to why younger people are presenting with colorectal cancer more often?
Yeah. So we know it's not genetics. We know that pretty confidently. It's not like there's an increased rate of Lynch syndrome or other hereditary colorectal cancer syndromes. We think it's an environmental exposure. So many cancers are related to environmental exposures. Colorectal cancer, you know, is no different, but there's not a clear consensus like there is with smoking that there's one overwhelming exposure. So it may be things like processed foods, particularly what we call ultra processed foods, so shelf stable foods, red meats, alcohol consumption, exercise, perhaps being above recommended body, you know, weight for your height. So there's a whole bunch of theories out there. I don't think we know exactly for sure. We just know it's continuing to rise.
Talking to Dr. Noelle Loconte, a medical oncologist at UW Health, looking at colorectal cancer. Overall numbers, good news, going down. Bad news, younger people showing up with it more and more often. You could join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Loconte, you mentioned symptoms. What kind of symptoms would people have that might make you think, okay, hey, maybe this is some kind of colorectal cancer?
Yeah, bleeding. So blood in the stool or even blood without a bowel movement, particularly bleeding that is persistent. Abdominal pain or unexplained weight loss. So you're not trying to lose weight. You're not, you didn't change your diet or exercise, but weight is coming off.
And then if someone has some of those symptoms, what are the diagnosis methods?
Yeah, I think what we see most often, especially in these young people, is that they have these prolonged periods of working up these symptoms where people are told, oh, it's hemorrhoids, oh, you have an anal fissure, it's irritable bowel disease. And we see these patients presenting over and over again for attention. And as with most cancers in colon and rectal cancer, the sooner we can diagnose it, the better the outcomes. So it's hard to, you know, on the end result, when they finally have cancer, realize like, oh, they've actually been presenting for care for sometimes a year or longer. So we really want people to go see their primary care doctor or a trusted healthcare provider to get those symptoms worked up. Under no circumstances should bleeding be assumed to be hemorrhoids, even in a young person. It really requires some further evaluation. But likewise for those other symptoms like abdominal pain or unexplained weight loss, the right test is colonoscopy for colon cancer.
And talk a little bit about the procedure of colonoscopy. It's something that I think people dread some. I've done it myself. The prep is not one of the more charming experiences we'll ever experience, but it's worth it. Talk us through that diagnostic.
Yeah. So the diagnostic colonoscopy, so if you're having symptoms, we have to clean out your bowel, which is called a bowel prep. Not very fun, but a necessary evil. So you take medication, usually liquid form, sometimes some pills and liquids, to force your bowels basically to completely evacuate. So there's a lot of diarrhea leading up to the procedure. Then when you go in for the procedure, it's done by general surgery, usually your gastroenterology. You're sedated most of the time, laid on your side. A camera's put into the rectum and then snaked all the way to the beginning of the colon and then slowly removed. The whole procedure takes, you know, 15 minutes. It's actually not that much time. Most of the time is spent getting you sedated and put in the right position. And then you go home. It takes a little bit of time to sleep off that sedation for some people, but then by the next day, you should be back to normal.
And reports are that I was very entertaining when I came out of procedure. I don't remember a thing about that, though.
That's great.
We got a call from Angie in Madison who couldn't stay on the line. She says, first of all, Dr. Loconte was my mom's oncologist, and she saved her life. Also, a question, is there a correlation, Angie asked, between any other digestive conditions like diverticulitis and colon cancers?
Yeah, great question. So irritable bowel and chronic constipation do not seem to increase your risk. There are certain GI conditions that absolutely do, ulcerative colitis being kind of top of the list. Ulcerative colitis is an inflammatory bowel disease, so chronic inflammation in the colon. diverticulitis generally would not increase your risk dramatically. And then certain conditions that suppress your own immune system. So if you're on chronic immunosuppression for whatever reason, increases your rate of all cancers, not just colon cancer.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Oshkosh. Joe, hello.
Hi there. So I'm calling because I went to the eye doctor a while ago, and they found a cluster of freckles on my eyes and actually told me that it's an indicator for something called Gardner syndrome, which increases your rate of colon cancer. I'm 26, so this program right now, I have questions about it. How concerned should I be about Gardner syndrome, and is there a non-invasive way to screen for it, or is colonoscopy the best way?
Joe, thanks for the call. First of all, this Gardner's syndrome, is that something, Dr. Locanti, that is correlated with colorectal cancer?
Yeah, it sure is. Gardner's syndrome is a syndrome where patients can get lots of polyps in their colon. We haven't really talked about this, but colon cancer arises first as a polyp, and then that turns into a larger polyp that then turns into an invasive carcinoma. So yes, patients with Gardner's syndrome are at very high risk of colon cancer. The second question, and you know, Joe, I'm not your doctor, so of course you should absolutely run this by your actual doctors, but there is a blood test to confirm Gardner syndrome. If you have it, we generally do recommend a more intensive screening program for a variety of cancers, not just colon cancer. There are non-invasive ways to screen for colon cancer if you're at average risk. I would not put somebody with a hereditary syndrome, though, in that average risk bucket. So I think colonoscopy is going to be the best bet here. Or if someone has, you know, Lynch syndrome being the most common type of hereditary colon cancer syndrome, but there's a number of them. But I think that's an important caveat with, you know, at-home screening. I think all of us in Wisconsin have seen like Cologuard ads on the TV. That's a Wisconsin company. That's really meant for average risk patients.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. You mentioned a Lynch syndrome, this Gardner syndrome. Are there other things in somebody's life that might say, hey, even if you don't have symptoms, maybe you should look at getting this checked out, a family history or other conditions?
Yeah, so family history in a first-degree relative, so that would be sibling, parent, or child, does increase your rate of colon cancer, but also a family history of not just cancer, but polyps, particularly the precancerous type of polyps. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't routinely talk to my parents about their colonoscopy results, but maybe we should, you know. There's also this concept in colorectal cancer screening, especially where people are kind of embarrassed or ashamed to talk about their testing, their diagnosis, and that can really hurt younger generations, because if you don't know about a family history, you can't advocate or qualify for earlier screening. But to answer your question more directly, yes, a first-degree relative with either colon cancer or what are called adenomatous polyps would increase your risk, and you could get screened earlier.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Dr. Noel Locanti, medical oncologist at UW Health. We're talking about the recent rise in rates of colorectal cancer in younger people, how to know if you're at risk, looking at some of the risks, the symptoms, the treatments, the diagnosis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you or a loved one had a colorectal cancer diagnosis? Do you wish you'd been screened earlier? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our conversation with Dr. Noel Locanti, medical oncologist at UW Health, associate professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking to her about the recent rise in rates of colorectal cancer in younger people, even as it goes down among older people, in part because of early detection of polyps. Looking at some of the possible causes, what to watch for, when to seek treatment. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Brandon is with us in Green Bay. Brandon, hi. You're on the air, Brandon. Go ahead.
Thanks, Rob. I'm in a bad spot for my cell phone. I've read that toilet paper and different bathroom products can are made with PFAS. It's detectable levels, and I'm wondering if there's any correlation between younger people who may their entire life using a bathroom product like that versus maybe older people who've had more of a natural tissue-based bathroom product.
Brandon, thanks for the call. Now, something like PFAS chemicals in products, Brandon mentioned, also in drinking water in many communities, Dr. Locanti, what would it take to establish if there were a connection between that class of chemicals and colorectal cancer? I don't think we're there at this point,
yeah,
right?
We're not there yet. PFAS is really thought to be an endocrine disruptor, and colorectal cancer is not really a hormone-sensitive type of cancer like breast or testicular cancer. But how do we prove a carcinogen? It's quite challenging, actually, for a couple of reasons. Most carcinogens are not that strong of an effect, so you have to have a big exposure over a long amount of time. You know, the one exception here would be smoking and tobacco, which strongly is correlated with a number of cancers. But most environmental exposures only slightly increase your risk, and most of us are not exposed to these things very frequently. So there's a whole scientific study devoted to trying to figure out exactly how much these increase your risk. People also move around. We can't do randomized trials where we expose half the people to PFAS, half not to. So we do like retrospective reviews where we ask people, well, where did you live growing up and how much did you drink your water and these kind of things. And then we try to triangulate around it, but it's actually quite difficult. You know, there's a few example of these so-called cancer clusters across the U.S., but they're very, very hard. The bar is quite high to prove that.
Brandon, thanks a lot for the question. We'll go down to Joe in Loganville. Joe, hello.
Hello. I just, for one, I'm a 12-year colon cancer survivor. Thanks to Dr. Locanti. She was my oncologist at the time.
Oh, my gosh. All my patients are calling in. It's great.
Yeah.
And did you want to tell us a little bit about your... Yeah, go ahead, Joe. Yeah.
We did find Lynch syndrome in my genes, so I do, you know, I'm a higher risk person, from what I understand, for colon cancer. I don't know what else to say right at the moment. Just big shout out to Dr. Locanti. Yeah.
Well, and Joe, I wanted to ask, I mean, you're sharing your story some. Are you hoping that more people share their stories, get the word out to maybe catch things hopefully earlier than you caught your own colorectal cancer?
Definitely. I'm not bashful to talk to people about colonoscopies and tell them my results and tell them they need to get in to get checked. Early 60s and anybody in my age bracket and younger, I'm a big promoter of getting colon. It's, you know, people worry about the prep and all that. And I've had so many, I lost count. And it's not as bad as everybody makes it sound. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, just have some books standing by, Joe. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It does seem, Dr. Locanti, like we're more willing to talk about colonoscopies. You know, we've had high-profile media personalities do them on TV. Yeah. I'd be a little reluctant. I don't know what I'd say on TV. But it does seem like people like Joe and others are willing to serve as ambassadors to get the word out.
Yeah, there's still populations where it's not socially acceptable to talk about it. So you're right. I mean, I think also people like Chadwick Boseman really helped us open up lines of communication. But we all have colons, right? We all are at risk, so we all should be talking about it.
Thanks again for calling in, Joe, and sharing your story. We're talking to Dr. Noel Locanti, UW Health medical oncologist, working at colorectal cancer, in part because of numbers over the last 20 years now showing it increasing among younger people than you would usually expect. People under the age of 50, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Dot is with us in Chippewa Falls. Dot, hello.
Hi, I have a question. For a couple of days, I was passing blood, a lot of blood, so I had a colonoscopy and was diagnosed with colitis. And I was wondering if you had information on a remedy or something to take to prevent any more problems.
Dot, thanks a lot for the call. And, of course, you can't really treat people over the phone, Dr. Locanti, but are there common treatments for colitis, and do we worry about colitis and any connection to colon cancer?
Yeah, colitis can be a shortened name for ulcerative colitis, which is that high-risk condition. So, for sure, Dot, you should be seeing primary care and probably gastroenterology to help set forth your treatment plan. There are multiple treatments for it. Most require something prescribed by a physician. So I would not recommend the natural route here, but yes, you need ongoing care and follow-up.
Dot, thanks for the call. Jim is with us now in Mount Hope. Jim, hi. Jim, are you there?
Hello.
Yep, you're on the air,
yeah.
Jim. Go ahead.
Well, as I said, I just had a colonoscopy not too long ago. Had 9 polyps they removed. They said, I'll see you in 2 years. Went back to a different doctor because insurance changed. They found 3. And then they told me 5 years. So I'm just wondering, is that kosher or...
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, Dr. Locanti, when somebody has had polyps, what are some of the guidelines as to how frequently thereafter they have that next colonoscopy?
Yeah, it depends. Devil's in the details, right? Mm-hmm. So it depends on the type of polyp. So hyperplastic polyps are sort of, they're not precancerous. They're just little folds or wrinkles in the lining of the bowel. Those don't increase your risk at all. And if that's all you have, you just need your colonoscopy every 5 years. If you have what are called adenomatous polyps, there's 3 flavors of those, but they all end in the word adenoma. Those are the kind that can turn into cancer. And so it depends on where they were found, the number, were they flat, were they on a little stalk? So it's quite complicated, but could be as frequently as every year until we clear out all the polyps, could be as infrequently as every 3 years. So, and then we have to factor in things like how healthy is the patient otherwise, how many times have they had these procedures, how was their prep? So there's a lot that goes into that. It's really driven by the doctor that did the colonoscopy.
Thanks for that call, Jim. In just our last minute or so, Dr. Locanti, we don't know exactly what's causing colorectal cancer, but what kind of lifestyle things can we do to at least nudge our risk down a little bit?
Yeah. Great question. Regular exercise, trying to be fruit and veggie forward in our diet. So shooting for 6 to 8 servings daily, which is harder than you think. Limiting red meat, limiting heavily processed foods. So we say shop the edges of the grocery store. So that would be, you know, produce, deli, freezer, but not in those areas of the grocery store where things are shelf stable, where they can stay on the shelf for years and years and years. That usually means there's tons of preservatives in there. I think patients can get screened and should get screened starting at the age of 45, maybe earlier if you have a family history. And then if you have symptoms, getting checked out rapidly.
And very briefly for healthcare providers, do they need to be more on the lookout in younger people for colorectal cancer?
For sure, yes. We see this where patients get ignored for extended periods of time. So yes, we want primary care, urgent care, emergency room. When a patient, young patient presents with bleeding, we want colon and rectal cancer to be on that list right away.
Dr. Locanti, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
That's Dr. Noelle Locanti, UW Health Medical Oncologist and Associate Professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We talked to her about what's behind the rise of colorectal cancer in younger people over the last couple decades and how to know if you are at risk. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, another government funding deadline in Congress, and longtime Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell says he'll step down from that role. We're going to get the latest news from the nation's capital. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with some baking inspired by Scandinavian traditions. We'll meet the author of the cookbook, Scandinavian from Scratch. If you are already baking that way, love to hear from you right now. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.